I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. High numbers of aging inmates are a very expensive problem for Kansas. The treatments that many of them require are putting a financial strain on the state, but one proposed bill is attempting to ease that burden. Today, what is in this new piece of legislation? It would allow the state to release inmates expected to die within 120 days. We'll ask how else it could affect Kansas's overcrowded prisons. Later, hear about the work being done to bridge the divide between Kansas lawmakers. Two state representatives share how classes in civil discourse are already making for a more productive legislature. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas has a lot of aging prisoners, and that's a problem. It's a very expensive problem. The prison system now houses more than 300 inmates over age 65, some of whom are dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's, not to mention other health issues that come with advanced age. Altogether, Kansas has the 13th highest percentage of aging inmates in the country. Under one bill before the legislature this year, the state could release inmates expected to die within 120 days. The current limit is 30 days. All this is due to the harsher sentences that legislatures like the one in Kansas adopted over the years. With us here to talk about the cost and strain of aging inmates are Randy Bowman. He's Executive Director of Public Affairs for the Kansas Department of Corrections. Randy, welcome. Nice to have you.
Good morning. Thank you.
State Representative Dennis Boog Heiberger is also here. He's back. He's a Lawrence Democrat. He sits on the Joint Committee on Corrections and Juvenile Justice Oversight. He's also a member of the Kansas Sentencing Commission. Representative, nice to have you, too. Welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
Well, Representative Heiberger, I'm guessing that this is an issue that most Kansans really probably don't think a whole lot about.
I expect that's true, although it probably should be. We're looking at a pretty serious overcrowding problem in our prison system, and if we don't address it really soon, we're going to be looking at the possibility of building a new prison at the cost of $150 to $200 million and $40 to $50 million a year operating costs.
And so that would affect every taxpayer in the state.
Absolutely.
You know, Randy, how common is it these days when you go into prisons to see inmates in wheelchairs getting around with walkers, you know, that kind of thing?
That certainly is not an uncommon phenomenon, as you described. You know, we've got that population over 65. We've got another about 300. So a total 6% of our population is over the age of 60.
Hmm. And you can tell when you walk in sometimes?
Sometimes you can.
Yes. Yeah. You know, this problem has grown so profound that the governor, Laura Kelly, plans to retrofit unused buildings near a prison down in Winfield, which is south of Wichita, for a growing population of elderly inmates. Randy, what would that cost?
So we're looking at a 2-year construction period for that. So the total over those 2 years would be just under about $9.8 million, our estimate.
Okay. And what would you have to do to the building to make it more usable for an aging prison population?
Yeah. So part of why those buildings are really a good match to this need is one of the buildings was built for older populations from the Kansas Veterans Home in the past. So that's helpful. But we'll need to go in. It's not been occupied for, I think, a couple of decades. So we're going to need to go in and update some things, clean some things up, those types of activities.
That's why a $10 million price tag.
Yes, yeah.
What's the whole point of having a segregated unit for aging inmates? What are you trying to accomplish there?
Yeah, so today when these gentlemen are at that phase of life, just like our parents or grandparents might be, where their health's not very good and they don't get around so well, if they need more intensive care, they end up in our infirmary beds. So it just kind of blocks our infirmary beds from those who just may get ill or have an injury. So we need to get a special space for them. And then they also just don't get around well. A prison's a pretty harsh place for somebody that doesn't walk very well to get around the building.
Do they tend to be more in danger as well because they really can't defend themselves all that well?
Well, that certainly could be that element. There is also a little bit of respect in that population, though, of elderly, like hopefully we would respect our elders.
You know, the geriatric patients that need to be moved to these facilities, what type of criminal history might they have?
Well, they'll run the gamut. A lot of that population, we looked at 660 of our folks that were over the age of 60, and 212 of those are serving life sentences. So as you might imagine with a life sentence, they've done the most harmful crimes in under Kansas law that you might imagine.
Representative Heiberger Boog, what do you think of this idea of segregating some of these aging inmates in this new facility, refurbished facility down in Winfield?
Well, it sounds like an improvement, but I really would like to focus more on actual release of incapacitated inmates for a couple of reasons. One, I mean, especially there are two categories. There's a terminal release for people who are about to die, and then there's a broader compassionate release for other medical reasons. Now, if we are able to expand Medicaid in Kansas, if inmates are released from confinement, then we will be able to use Medicaid dollars to pay for their care and get it off the Department of Corrections budget.
So you're saying if we expand Medicaid, we can use those dollars to help the prison population?
For people who are not in confinement.
Yeah, okay. I can't help but wonder if guards are properly trained, Randy, to handle these inmates.
Our plan with this will be to add some training for that for our staff population to meet that need. Absolutely.
Yeah. And what do they need to be able to do that they can't do now?
Well, today, you know, their role isn't really to help elderly folks take care of themselves, do the self-care types of things. And then we also plan to train some of our inmate population to help in that self-care as well.
Do you have enough guards right now who are available to help this population?
Well, one of the benefits of these buildings being available at Winfield, having the construction that they do, Winfield's the prison where we have had the least historical challenge with hiring. It varies day to day, but we're running one or zero vacancies in our uniformed staff down there right now.
Why would that be?
Well, smaller community is probably a factor. But ultimately, the raises that the Kansas legislature passed last year that allowed us to go from a little over $15 an hour to a little over $18 an hour has had a meaningful impact on our hiring ability since past summer.
Because that was a big issue last summer, the guard shortage. And what are you seeing across the system now in the wake of that increase in pay?
Yeah, we are down over 40% on our vacancies with that. We do have that facility and another one that are running right around full staff right now.
So how many vacancies system-wide do you have, just roughly?
I don't have that number in my head right
okay.
now.
Sorry. What's the cost of caring for an aging inmate compared to the cost of caring for a healthy inmate?
Well, you'd certainly expect it would be more, and we would agree with that. But the way our accounting system is set up, it's by facility, not by special type of population. So I can't give you a firm cost, but the assumption that they are more expensive because they have more medical care, they require more staff time, I think is a fair assumption.
Representative?
Well, in testimony that we heard at committee, the estimate was three to nine times more for an incapacitated prisoner.
3 to 5 times?
3 to 9 times.
3 to 9 times.
Yes.
So considerably more expensive.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Representative, there's a bill in the legislature that you've referred to, and I've mentioned already, that would allow the state to release aging inmates who aren't expected to live beyond 120 days. Who would make the decision to release this inmate? How would it work?
Well, the Department of Corrections would make the application, and the decision would be made by the Prisoner Review Board.
And who sits on that board?
They're appointed by the governor, I believe.
Okay.
Yes. All of them. And there's a series of criteria in the statute that they're required to look at before release.
Things like what?
Age and history, criminal history, nature and circumstances of the offense, potential risk, and whether there's a care plan established.
The state now has a law that allows for release within 30 days of expected death. Do I have that right? And why do we need to change that?
Well, as you might expect, the applications often take more than 30 days to process, and inmates tend to die before the application's even approved. So most states that have a policy like this have at least 6 months, and I believe it's 18 months on the federal level.
18 months.
Yeah, we're real outliers there. I think Louisiana has 60 days. Everybody else is 6 months to 2 years.
Then why is our bill just calling for 120 days, which is 4 months? Why not draw that number out?
The Sentencing Commission wasn't ready to approve 6 months when we discussed it last summer. I was a little surprised, but the original bill was 90. There was an amendment in the committee to raise it to 120.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
I think I'd like to look at broadening it at some point. I'd really like to look at it really expanding our compassionate release policy also. The feds took a real big step that way a few years ago with the First Step Act. It really provided new procedures and categories for medical and compassionate release.
Mm-hmm.
And we do actually have a statute on the books now. It just hasn't very rarely used. I believe the last numbers I saw were 2 inmates in the last 7 years.
Now, people who are listening to this and think, boy, you might be releasing some dangerous people back out in society, I gather that's really not the case here.
No, I don't think the Prisoner Review Board releases people lightly. I think they're, and again, the criteria they have to consider includes the potential risk or threat to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do not see the Prisoner Review Board releasing people who would be a threat.
This is a situation, Randy, that is, I suppose the number of prisoners we're talking about here who might be eligible for release has gone up in recent years in the wake of the Get Tough on Crime push in the 90s that put so many more people in prison for longer periods.
Yeah, our population has just gone up and up for decades in Kansas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To what extent would this result in lowering, easing that problem of overcrowding in our prisons?
Dropping the bucket. I can't see this applying to more than 1 or 2 people a year. I mean, this current bill.
Just 1 or 2 people a year.
Right. I mean, if you look at the current statute, people in prison for an off-grid offense aren't eligible. So both of our 80-plus-year-old inmates are off-grid, and I think 27 of the 47 people in the 70s are off-grid. So there's like a big chunk of the population who are elderly who would not be eligible. But of course, terminal illness can strike at any age, obviously. But
I mean, what's motivating this push to increase this early release for aging and terminally ill inmates, Boog? Is it mercy? Is it saving money? Is it to reduce the declining number of inmates the state is holding at any one moment? Or what would you say?
Well, I mean, I initiated this at the Sentencing Commission, and I think it's probably a mix of all those things. And you know, to be honest, it was probably inspired by a public radio story of what people were doing in other states. But I think this is one issue that does can combine compassion and fiscal responsibility, because it definitely – you know, I think compassion, even for people who have committed serious offenses, to release them to die with their loved ones, I think is a good, compassionate thing to do. And again, these early release programs can save the state money also.
Is this bill going to pass?
It passed the House by a vote of, I believe, 120-5. So I hopefully the Senate will consider it in the same light.
How concerned are you about the logjam of bills in the legislature right now, with the breakdown, with a Medicaid expansion being held hostage for an abortion law?
I'm very frustrated. There was a lot of good work by a lot of good people that got left to die on the calendar this year, especially one bill affecting good time credit in our prisons that was the biggest prison bed savings of any bill I've seen in the last 6 years. It could go by itself, it would come very close to solving our prison overpopulation problem. It was left to die below the line.
Below the line, meaning?
I'm using State House talk. It was on the calendar during what we call our turnaround day, so the day the bill has to pass out of House of Origin, and it wasn't acted on. Leadership didn't put it up for a vote, so it's dead for the session.
We're going to talk more about the Medicaid expansion idea in our second half of our show today. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the aging prison population in Kansas and how much more that's costing the state as a result. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Randy, I want to make sure we're sort of bringing everybody up to speed here. We sort of have talked about it briefly here, but prison overcrowding, guard shortages, prisoner unrest have been issues in recent years in Kansas prisons around the state. Again, just to give us an update here, to what extent has the state, in your view, begun to move past these issues?
So that the increased wages last session by the Kansas legislature was very valuable to helping us hire more people. The legislature also appropriated some money last year to help us upgrade some of the safety equipment for our staff. We're very grateful for that as well. So we're making some progress. There are things in our budget this year that we asked for again, this project, more equipment, replacement of worn out automobiles. Thus far in the budget process, those are progressing. So we're going to remain hopeful that mm-hmm. we'll come to the end of the session, we might take another step forward in improving the safety for our employees and for the residents who live in our facilities.
Representative Heiberger, how would you summarize where we are with some of these issues right now?
Meaning the funding issues?
Or? Well, just the prisoner, the guard shortages, the prison overcrowding, funding. Give us an update.
I think we're making some progress on the funding, I think, with regard to prison overcrowding. The committees have taken some good steps this year, but so far it's all been shut down. So I'm really frustrated. I don't think people understand the gravity of the situation.
Well, how could they not, given the headlines in Kansas in recent years about unrest and perhaps a near riot at one of our facilities that could have been incredibly traumatic for the inmates, not to mention the state?
Well, at the risk of being political, I think part of the problem is that the problem is the governor's problem in the short run. And so
Meaning what? Explain what you're talking about.
If they're prison overcrowding, any problems with the prison are the governor's problem for right now. And I think that stands in the way, possibly, of getting a long-term solution.
Are you suggesting that maybe some members of the legislature want to embarrass the governor, have problems occur on her watch to drive her numbers down?
Oh, heavens no.
But you're being facetious.
I am.
Yeah. That's a pretty dramatic thing to say.
That's the climate I see at the State House right now. I mean, yeah. I haven't seen a very much cooperation from House and Senate leadership on things that I think really should be bipartisan to help make the state go forward.
Here we are talking about a prison population that's hardly a high-value issue in terms of where going to win people elections, going to cost people elections, and you're suggesting that maybe politics is very much at play even on that level.
Well, I can't tell you that for sure, but I am really disappointed that especially our good time credit bill didn't get acted on. I think it was a really big step toward fixing our prison overcrowding problem.
So again, you're saying there were steps that could have been taken this session and still could be taken in theory that could drive down that overcrowding issue pretty dramatically.
Yes, I think there's some bills outstanding that could make a very, very much progress toward solving our prison problem.
Yeah, highlight one of those, the good time bill.
The good time credit, yes.
Yeah, tell us about that.
As it came out of committee, it would increase the good time credit available for inmates to 25% of the sentence for people convicted of violent offenses and to 40% for people convicted of nonviolent offenses. The projected prison savings on that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Randy, I believe it's 150 for next year and 900 and some for 2019. And our projected overcrowding level by 2029, is around a little over 1,000. So it would make a great stride toward easing our potential overcrowding problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to add on to that, the Kansas Sentencing Commission does the official projections, and by 2029, they're projecting where the Kansas prison population is going to be about 11,400, approaching 11,500. We've got about 10,000 beds today. The two proposals that Secretary Zamuda and the governor put forward to the legislature this session would give us enough capacity through about 2023, but absent some kind of policy change by the legislature, we're going to be forced to come back and ask for construction, it would seem.
I'm just sitting here, Boog, and again, I've covered legislatures for a long time. I've seen a lot of stuff. But legislation like this seems like such a no-brainer, given the atmosphere, the environment that has surrounded Kansas prisons in recent years.
Right. Well, I think that's why we were able to get some progress on the funding issue. But I think I'm not sure why we're not able to get it on some of these issues that would affect prison overcrowding. I think some people don't want to be seen as soft on crime, and that's always an issue there. But
it's an election year. Might that be a factor?
Certainly could. Yeah, I'm just not sure that the gravity of the situation has sunk in with the majority of the legislature.
Wow. Okay, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to some calls. And Susan from Leavenworth. Susan, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, thank you for letting me talk. I wanted to make two short statements and then ask a question, if that's all right.
Sure.
First, thank you. I think generally time is too long and too torturous for people for many things.
Sentences you're talking about, Susan, do I understand right? You're talking about prison sentences here. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, sir. And the other thing I wondered is why can, and also I think violent crime should have their labels and they need to be looked into and cut down. The other question is why can't good time and compassion be put together? Why does a person need to be dying to get out? That's all I wondered.
Yeah, go ahead, Susan.
Oh, thank you. I want to say one more thing. I think that politicians might be very surprised at how the general public would support them if they were not saying, oh, I'm strong on crime all the time, and begin to look at our actual population across the United States.
Right. Susan, thanks for the call. Do you think the politics on this are beginning to change, that people are more open to the idea of good time credits and the kinds of issues you're outlining, Boog?
I think there's a growing bipartisan consensus for prison reform. Yeah, even the Koch brothers groups are supporting prison reform. I think they maybe finally realize that it costs money to keep people in prison. But I think there is a growing basis for bipartisan action here.
Next to the good time credit, are there other bills that are floating around the legislature that you would point to, Representative, that might be helpful here?
Do we have some bills that affect our sentencing registry? And
what is that?
In Kansas, we have one of the most extensive offender registries in the country for a number of sex crimes, drug crimes, and violent crimes. And a great number of our prison population is in for probation and post-release supervision violations. And so and a lot of those involve violations of the registry conditions. So the more we can make those more fair and rational, I think that will help decrease our prison population. Randy may have other bills he'd like to comment on.
Randy?
Those are ones I was going to touch upon, but I was going to come back to the good time. It really, from our vantage point as corrections professionals, it's a nice tool because it incentivizes the guys and gals while they're in our facility to have mm-hmm. better behavior so they can get out.
Yeah.
So we view it as it really could help us have safer facilities if there was a greater incentive for those folks.
You know, we just did a show this week, Representative, with an author of a new book on the parole and probation system. And how cutting edge is Kansas when it comes to, you know, providing services like jobs, mental health care, and the like to offenders who are walking out of prison these days or are on parole for that matter?
Yeah, I'm probably not the best person to answer that. I think Randy's probably more up to speed on our release policies. I think we've made some progress, so I think there's ways to go.
How cutting edge are we on that front, Randy, as you look at our situation right now?
Yeah, so the Department of Corrections has been making investments for many years, back into the early 2000s, in what we refer to in the field as evidence-based practices.
Mm-hmm.
But the challenge we primarily focus on today, and we've talked a lot with legislative committees about, is there's a resource limitation. Those who need sex offender treatment, we can't reach them all. Those who need substance abuse treatment, we can't reach them all.
Why?
We don't have enough funding to provide the slots to get the guys and gals in treatment.
I mean, the argument is, short of having that funding, we continue a recidivism issue that continues to plague us and leads to crime rates that are higher than acceptable levels.
Yes. The investments we've done over the last, as I said, back to our 2000s, we've decreased recidivism measured at 3 years post-release in Kansas from 55% to about 34%. But mm-hmm. we think with some investments, we could push that number down a little farther, mm-hmm. and we think that's better for the public.
Okay. Let me go back to some calls here. Latasha from Stillwell, Kansas. Latasha, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the call. My question is really related to, do you think that the blocking from the legislature have anything to do with the for-profit components of prison?
Representative, what about that?
No, I don't. We do not have for-profit prisons.
I was going to say.
In Kansas. We do have, because of our overcapacity issue, we have sent 120 inmates to a for-profit prison in Arizona, but our hope is to get them back in Kansas as soon as possible.
That's costing us a lot of money, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little over $72 a day for those guys, which is really kind of comparable to our per-day cost here in Kansas, but we are working to get those folks back in Kansas, hopefully even this summer.
But we're spending millions?
Yes.
Yes, okay. One more phone call here from Leslie from Mission Hills. Leslie, you're on the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I really appreciate this conversation, and I think that the you can't sound incredulous because you picked the topic, right? But at the same time that it may be difficult for people to move on this in the legislature, part of it is by having these shows, which makes it clear that, you know, this is a topic that we need to put pressure on those legislators who might otherwise just want to play politics with their opponent that they see as their opponent in the governor's mansion. And so to that, as somebody who goes up to Topeka, you know, on my own free will, on my own time, I've been shocked this year really at how pervasive the problem is that Booth just highlighted. And when I meet with the legislators and others who are up there trying to digest these problems, one of the things you have to do is make sure that you put it in context. This is, and Randy was just saying, this is a funding issue. And we are living out, you know, the effects of what happened under the previous administration, where everything was cut for one balancing act on the tax side, and we didn't, and he just labeled it, he used the word investment. So I appreciate this conversation. We have to keep it going, and we need to keep it contextual in the big picture, because it's a public health issue, as we've heard. You know, it's just a broad thing. So thank you for having the topic.
Yeah.
But don't be incredulous when Boo brings up that it's political, because it is.
Okay. I got you, Leslie. I appreciate that. Who should people call a representative if they want to have some impact on an issue like this? Where would you have them place a phone call?
I think on the House side, the members of the Corrections and Juvenile Justice Committee, we're the ones who see a lot of the bills. But in terms of getting bills moving through, the roadblock appears to be at the upper leadership of the House. Mm-hmm. I would have them call the Speaker of the House.
Yeah, okay. One more call here. Ryan from Grandview. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi. Just real quick, I think maybe one of the reasons why it's being blocked is because when a ex-con is released from prison, they have the right to vote, and typically, statistically, ex-cons can vote Democratic, so I think it could be a form of voter suppression.
Luke, what do you think about that? Voter suppression or not?
It's possible. I haven't really thought about it that way. I mean, in Kansas, felons can vote as soon as their term is completely served.
Okay. Well, let's leave our conversation there. That was the voice of State Representative Dennis Boog Heiberger. He's a Lawrence Democrat. Randy Bowman also joined us. He's with the Kansas Department of Corrections. Gentlemen, thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
While we're on the topic of a Kansas legislature, when we come back, we're going to talk about the push toward more civility in Topeka. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. When you move your clock forward this weekend, rest easy knowing you're 1 hour closer to receiving my Monday newsletter. That's if you subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. Kraske Off Mic is where you'll find highlights from the show and exclusive content from me. Don't miss out. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to sign up. A Monday show will be one day away from Missouri's Democratic presidential primary. Up to Date will bring you a panel forecasting the road ahead in Missouri politics before Tuesday's Democratic presidential primary. Well, Missouri Representative Emanuel Cleaver has pushed for more civility in Congress for years. Now a group of state legislators in Topeka are looking for ways to bring more civil discourse to the halls of the state capitol. Organizers have offered three sessions so far, and at the first workshop on an icy day in January, nearly half the legislature showed up. Joining us on to talk about this push for better relations in the State House are two of the leaders of this push toward civility. They are State Representative Kathy Wolf Moore. She's a Democrat from Kansas City, Kansas. Representative Wolf Moore, nice to have you back again. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Also with us, State Representative Stephen Johnson. He's a Republican from Osaria, which, in case you're wondering, is just south of Salina. Representative Johnson, nice to have you too. Welcome.
great to be with you, Steve.
Well, I've got to tell you, there's some irony in our topic this morning. Last night, the Topeka Capital Journal ran a big story on its website with this headline, and I'm quoting, Senate Republicans blast Majority Leader for working with Governor on Medicaid expansion. The Majority Leader, of course, is Senator Jim Denning from Johnson County. He's a Republican. The Governor is Laura Kelly, and she's a Democrat. Senator Denning and Governor Kelly made a couple of joint appearances in Wichita a few days ago in what was billed as a bipartisan push for Medicaid expansion. Representative Wolf Moore, so much for bipartisanship here.
Well, I actually think that our Senate president has it exactly wrong. I think that what Kansans demand, at least in my district and what I hear, is that people come together and work and compromise and do what's best for Kansans, not what's best for the next election cycle. And so I applaud what Senator Denning and what the governor have done to come up on a compromise on Medicaid expansion. I think that's exactly the way we should operate.
Well, Representative Johnson, help me with this. Then why was Senator Denning then publicly upbraided, if you will, on the floor of the state Senate yesterday in Topeka?
Well, I don't know if any of us can answer why those things come up and happen, but each of these situations usually has quite a backstory. How did we get to that point? We have issues that people do disagree, and that's the nature of any governing body. How do you settle those things, and how do we work together to find that way forward? But I think when we look back, we know that Senator Denning was at the center of the work a year ago when we were trying to come to a budget solution, who I believe was the one that made the promise, we will take up this issue in the Senate when we get back in January.
Right.
And I think he is continuing to work on that while those that oppose Medicaid expansion continue to hold their ground on that. And I think it's just the friction of that that we're seeing as the outcome.
Representative Wolf Moore, Senate President Susan Weigel said Jim Denning had betrayed his caucus by teaming up with a Democrat. Does that sound right to you?
Well, I think the point is being missed here is who's betrayed is the public when people don't work together. So I think that's getting lost in this. Once again, I have to say, I think that that is exactly the kind of behavior the public wants to see. They want us to compromise. They want us to work together. And most of all, they want us to come up with a solution that's best for them. Mm-hmm. And I think we're losing sight of that in this whole debacle.
Representative Johnson, your colleague here is from Kansas City, Kansas, an urban district. Are you hearing some of that same compromise talk out in the Salina area in rural Kansas?
I think so. And I don't know that people necessarily think of compromise because I think that the divisions actually run fairly deep and run outside of the state house as well. But I genuinely think that people do want us to work together. How do we figure out those solutions? How do we state our best case? And to quote Arthur Brooks in his book, he says, how do you disagree well?
Mm-hmm.
And respect that difference is there. And let's work through this. Let's figure out the best solution and then make sure that we go forward together. So it's that working together piece that I think is important. And that does over time have compromise. It means there are issues that I will make my case and we'll take that plan forward. And there are other cases where I'll learn that there's a better way. Mm-hmm. I have to be open to that. I have to be open to the fact that I don't have all the best ideas.
Well, let's talk about this push towards civility here. Representative Wolf Moore, why do you think the Kansas legislature needed lessons in civility? I mean, people tend to associate a lack of civility with Washington, not Topeka, Kansas.
Well, I think precisely because of what's going on in Washington, D.C. I mean, I can't think of a time, at least in my lifetime, when I've seen more ugliness at the federal level. I mean, bullying, name-calling, you name it.
Does that spill over to Topeka?
Well, I think it does because I think in some ways that kind of behavior makes it okay for us to do the same sort of behavior in Topeka. Now, that being said, I have to say that in Topeka, at least I can speak for the House and not for the Senate, certainly, because I'm in the House, as is Representative Johnson, that basically we have a really good group of people, but we have to get to know each other and we have to learn to talk to each other. Basically, that's what this has been about. When the national group came in, one of the first things we did was an exercise, and we split into groups, and we told something that had deeply affected us in our life. And the object of that really was that we get to know each other on a different level.
Yeah. You hear the same kind of concern in Washington, D.C., that the lawmakers, even though they sit together in the House of Representatives, that they really don't know each other. There's 435 of them out in D.C. I think there's 125 in Topeka. And it's hard for you guys to get to know each other, even though you're sitting side by side.
It can be hard. I think it's harder in Washington because of the travel that they have. A lot of folks are headed back to hear things in their district, to focus on campaign efforts that are always ongoing. I think in Topeka we have it a little bit easier because the time that we are together is pretty focused. So we are there for the week. But even I'm going to break down the formalities. Kathy and I came in together 10 years ago and had the chance to work together on a lot of committees. But other colleagues, it helped, even though I thought I knew them pretty well, to actually have that space to sit down and get more background on where they're coming from.
Yeah. Well, why did you, Representative, why did you want to push towards civility? What issues were you seeing that brought you into this game?
Well, I don't know that there was an issue, but what had struck me was a year ago last fall at the death of former Senator McCain and former President Bush.
Right.
I enjoyed seeing the country come together to celebrate things that had been accomplished for about 2 days in that time frame. And I also thought, you know, I think that Senator Dole would have that same type of an impact in focusing on what did we accomplish together for a bit of time. And the thought that I had, and I called Kathy at that time, I said, what if we could make something like that last longer? And how do we start that change? And we just started that process to talk to each other. We started to come across some other resources that we had, even right here in Kansas. Right. We were excited to discover Tim Schaefer, who leads the Institute for Civil Dialogue and Democracy at Kansas State, who works with the National Institute for Civil Discourse. We then contacted that institute and learned what they were doing with states just to try to help us get better at the process. Because what we're not worried about so much is what hangs in the balance in the Kansas legislature as the importance of democracy, which is based on the premise of an engaged citizenry. And it's not a bifurcated citizenry. It's one that's engaged on one set of facts and working towards one goal at a time, many goals. But we felt that was being lost, not necessarily in Topeka, but we wanted to reach out and see if we could grasp that more firmly and hopefully reach out outside of Topeka.
How was this idea received amongst your colleagues?
Well, I think
you first broached it to them.
Well, I want to mention a few more people that are involved in this. So this has been a Senate House bipartisan issue. So in the Senate, Senator Elaine Bower, Senator Tom Hawk, and also in the House is Representative Tom Phillips. So, you know, I can just speak for those four individuals. Those are four individuals that, beyond a shadow of a doubt, have a reputation for some of the most civil behavior every day and every minute of every day. So I think having those four people leading this effort helped the reception of it. And in fact, on January 17th, the first day we had this event, and we couldn't really cancel it because we had our National Institute for Civil Discourse people coming in to help us with the first session.
The weather was horrific that day.
It was an ice storm, and we had an amazing crowd of Kansas legislators. So that told us something that first day, that there was a real appetite for this, and there was a real interest in this.
But what else, what happened at that first session? And again, how remarkable it was that almost half the legislature showed up, if I understand right.
Yeah, not quite half. I think we had half signed up, but some of the people from Kansas City and Lawrence couldn't get in. But Stephen can probably talk about part of it, but the part that was so remarkable to me was I started to talk about it when we split into two groups, and we were supposed to talk about something that really made us who we were. The stories that we heard from other legislators were just, I mean, at times we were in tears, crying, you know.
Stories like just roughly, like what kinds of things?
How they grew up, what affected them in their life, how they became the person they were. And, you know, it gave us a real insight into who we are.
It really does change your perception of people, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And the other thing is, once you get to know someone on that level, it's a lot harder to be ugly or difficult. So I think that's sort of the secret sauce to this whole thing, is that we get to know each other on a level other than, well, if she's a Democrat, he's a conservative, he's a moderate. We got to know each other as people in our stories. And I think that is what really is what makes the difference in this program.
What did you take away from that day, Steve?
Well, a number of things. And the first was the setup there. And we also did have help from the leadership. The speaker sent out the invitation for us. The minority leaders and the Senate president did sign on to that initial invitation. And that helped reach everybody. And that was key. But in the planning team that had worked coming up to that, some of the things that we talked about is we want it to be more than that meeting. We know that that is an event that can help us, but what do we do? So we ended with action planning to say, okay, do we want to continue to meet? What are some other things that can come out of that? And there have been some good ideas that came up. One of the representatives had the idea for a lunch lottery where you just draw names and you go to lunch with somebody who you might not have otherwise done.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so we've had our first round of that, and that was useful just to get to know more about others on that individual basis. We started a word of the week just to keep things in people's minds. And there's another team that puts that together, and that's separate from the planning team that we talked about.
What are some of the words that have been tossed around?
The first word we had was vision, looking at what we wanted to do. The next word was trust, which was felt as one of the foundations that was necessary to be able to work through. And Representative Wolf Moore introduced the word for this week, which was empathy and understanding. So we try to announce that on each Monday. If folks are interested in following along, we post it on hashtag KSCivility. So there's a way on Twitter just to get an idea of what we're talking about there.
Yeah. And you have had a couple of other sessions in the wake of this first one, Kathy. What's happened there?
Well, we've had speakers at both of those sessions, but also we've made sure that we also include some kind of get to know you on a smaller scale than the first really big one we did, but just kind of a little opportunity to converse a little and talk a little bit more with people and learn a little more about them. And I think that might be what brings people back, because people really seem to enjoy that exercise. When you think about it, we sit by who we sit by. We office with, you know, the Democrats all office with the Democrats. And so unless you're in a committee with someone, you don't really get that opportunity to get to know them. So this is giving us that opportunity to get to know some people that we just normally wouldn't have the opportunity. I mean, we even thought about, but it wouldn't really work because of the way we vote. Wouldn't it be fun to mix it up on the floor and sit in different seats once in a while instead of the Democrats all on one side, the Republicans all on one side?
Why doesn't that happen?
Well, part of it's just logistics. I mean, we have to
strategize occasionally.
Well, not just that, technology. The way you vote, you have to be at your desk to cast your vote. So a lot of that's really technology more than anything else, or I think we would give that a try.
The whole idea of swapping offices and mixing members of different parties in different offices, I've often wondered about that over the years. But there's also the reality that the majority party gets the better offices compared to the minority party. And maybe that's, given that it's a little harder to make that suggestion, Representative. Is that true?
Well, committee chairs probably do get nicer offices, and I don't know how the rest of them necessarily stack
up. You
got
to come
up
to Jefferson City sometime. Okay. Very different experience than Topeka.
We are so blessed to have a wonderful building in Topeka. So, and I think you're right that generally those nicer offices are handed out that are there. But one of the members even suggested, when we're not having a vote, Kathy and I just swap chairs, as an example, just to sit and talk with somebody different, not anyway, to get to know their seatmates and then have them wonder, what are you doing? But anyway.
So I guess the big question then is, what's been the impact here? You've had a few sessions. Has there been any change, or is it hard to tell?
Well, it's really hard to measure, although I
sure
will say,
yeah.
Stephen and I have both discussed this, that we've had some really difficult issues, an abortion issue for one, which always is probably the most difficult issue we will ever talk about on the Kansas floor. And, you know, I don't know what accounted for this, but it did seem to be more of a civil conversation on the House floor than I would have predicted. So who knows what's having an impact on this.
Did you see it the same way, Steve?
We did. We both talked about that, and we genuinely feel that on a variety of issues, certainly the life issue in that discussion, the way people talked about it generally, how comments were made from the well where we speak in the House seemed to be more considerate of a number of those issues. But we also want to be careful. We don't necessarily know the cause, what created that. Did our specific efforts
right.
as a group have that? What else is there? But we think that's happening. And we're further excited by when people do engage on Facebook or wherever it is to try and carry that conversation on.
Interesting. Or maybe they're thinking in the back of their minds that people are aware this effort's underway here. You mentioned you partnered with a group called the National Institute for a Civil Discourse. Tell us about this group, because I know it's a national nonpartisan group, Steve.
Yeah. Right. So it's a group that actually started in the wake of Gabby Gifford's shooting, and the concept being we need to get better at talking about issues.
Mm-hmm.
So they now have a number of groups that have done that same concept that organized under them. One of them is called Next Gen, or for Next Generation. That's the group that works with state legislatures. Their initial goal was, how do we change Washington? And they thought, well, we think we change it by changing state legislatures and where we may come up with some of our next generation of leaders in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a focus that they've had. There's a Better Angels group that formed. It's active in this area as well. And their concept was, take a Trump supporter and a Clinton supporter, get them in the same room and get to understand each other.
Yeah.
And that group has been useful to work with under the National Institute of Civil Discourse. But that's the group then that came in and connected us with the group that led our session to start Topeka.
You know, am I right? I mean, it seems to me this can be such a conundrum for you guys, because voters insist they want a more civil legislature, and yet many of those same voters often cast ballots for leaders who tend to be more partisan, more outspoken. I mean, what about that? How do you square that circle?
Well, and that brings to a point that's sort of related that Stephen and I have talked about. So elections are uglier than they ever have been.
Right.
I mean, the ugly, they call them postcards, the mailers that go out during election season are so incredibly ugly. But the only reason those continue is because ugly works.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we reach a point where those aren't effective and maybe we'll have more civil elections? Because I've got to tell you, by the time we beat up on each other during an election season, and often it's not the members, it's outside special
of
interest
course it
groups.
Is. Yeah.
It's really hard to come back in and feel civil towards each other.
I can only imagine.
Because it gets incredibly personal. You know, all kinds of just outrageous.
So what is the answer to this? I mean, there are special interests and consultants who do this work. I mean, there's a way to reach those people who put those things out.
Well, I think part of it is part of what we hope this program will be. So Stevens really always stresses the fact that this isn't just about the Kansas legislature. That's why we've invited to join us, and they've been great partners, people like the Kansas Extension.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are people that do master facilitator programs. So the real success of this program is not just what goes on in the legislature, but how does this spread across Kansas?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the beginning of the answer. I mean, that's why the Sunflower Foundation is underwriting some of the cost of this program.
That's interesting.
Because they really believe that this is an effort that's worth funding across Kansas.
I got 30 seconds left, Representative. Do you see any hope for this thing spreading across the state?
I do. For the things that Kathy mentioned, I think are the key, and it is dealing with that election. It's people taking a breath, taking a huge step back and saying, where are we really? K-State Extension with the Master Facilitator Program is a way to get there. Here in the greater Kansas City area, the Church of the Resurrection has
yes.
a great series going on all the way through the election to try and make sure that we keep our conversations genuine, our conversations
mm-hmm.
real and focused on our real purpose.
Interesting. We'll have to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of State Representative Stephen Johnson, a Republican from Osaria. We're also joined by State Representative Kathy Wolf Moore, a Democrat from Kansas City, Kansas. Thank you both very much.
Appreciate
it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good luck. Keep it going.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Monday on the show, the wife of an indisputable jazz legend, Maxine Gordon, and how she's preserving her late husband's legacy. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scherer, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.